So good evening, everyone, and welcome to this evening talk titled How to Cultivate Mental Balance and Wellbeing. What we're going to be doing this evening is look at how we can really cultivate a state of well-being based on what's called the four types of mental balance, which are motivational, attentional, cognitive, and emotional. So for this evening session, I think we've got about 2 hours available. So we're going to start by defining what do we mean by well-being, and then we're going to look at each of these four types of mental balance. What are they? We're then going to look in a little bit more detail how to cultivate each one of those four so that we can really achieve that state of well-being. We're going to also look at the importance of an integrated model, why all four of these components are essential if we really want to achieve that state of well-being. And then we're going to also have plenty of time for question-answer at the end of that. And as Neil mentioned, about halfway through, at the sort of convenient point, we'll break 15 or 20 minutes for a cup of tea and some biscuits. Okay. And this evening's talk is based on this article here written some years ago called Mental Balance and Wellbeing by Alan Wallace and Shauna Shapiro. So I'm basing this evening's talk on this article, which either you've already maybe got a copy of, or I'll tell you how to get a copy of it after this evening's talk. Okay, so let's begin. So first, we'll have a look at what do we mean by this word well-being? And to begin that discussion, a couple of quotes from this article from Alan Wallace. He says, "The goal of Buddhist practice is the realization of a state of well-being that is not contingent on the presence of pleasurable stimuli, either external or internal." So what we really need to understand then, when we talk about well-being or a state of happiness, we need to clearly identify two types of happiness. There is what's called temporal happiness and genuine happiness. And temporal happiness basically is simply another word for pleasure, meaning temporal happiness is stimulus-based happiness. It's a state of happiness that comes from some stimulus. We have some stimulus, we have some pleasurable experience, and that is what's called temporal happiness. And the name, of course, suggests that this is not going to last. In fact, when the stimulus is finished, the happiness experience is finished, of course. So often, when we talk about striving for happiness, it's often people are pursuing this. They want more pleasure in the hope to have more happiness. But actually, in this talk this evening, we're not really focusing primarily on this. Rather, when we talk about a state of well-being, we're talking about a state of genuine happiness. The difference between these two is that temporal happiness is a stimulus-based happiness, whereas the state of genuine happiness or well-being is not stimulus-based. As Alan Wallace said here, it's a state of well-being that's not contingent upon any particular stimulus being present. And so that's what we are really focusing on here when we talk about a state of well-being and achieving that state of well-being. Now, often when this is ideas are explained within a Buddhist context, then often people feel like there is a choice, you know, meaning either we have to have one or the other. And so, therefore, often people feel like in Buddhism that somehow we have to sort of give up our pleasure because otherwise we're not striving for genuine happiness. But actually, this is a complete misunderstanding of the Buddhist spiritual path. And in fact, to quote again from Alan Walsh's article here, he says, "The enjoyment of such transient pleasures is not in opposition to the cultivation of positive attitudes and commitments or the cultivation of the types of mental balance that yield inner well-being. In fact, one may derive greater enjoyment from hedonic pleasures as a result of cultivating well-being." So often people are under this misapprehension that if we're going to strive for genuine happiness, somehow we have to leave pleasures behind, or it's actually even wrong or bad. We're a bad Buddhist if we're enjoying pleasurable experiences. But again, this is a complete misunderstanding. And so it's not somehow that in our striving for genuine happiness, we're going to miss out on the pleasures of life, the simple pleasures of life. As he said, actually, it's the exact opposite. What you'll find is that the more we strive for genuine happiness, in general, the more you will find that you will enjoy the simple pleasures in life. In fact, I can give a concrete example of that. Some years ago, when I did my first long retreat, I was in Spain on the side of a mountain, beautiful view. It was a place, retreat centre, that provided meals, very nutritious meals, but tended to be the same menu every week. So every week, the same, week after week, same food. So we know from our own experience, if there's some meal, food we enjoy, but we're eating it week after week after week, after some weeks, we sort of go, oh, no, not that again. But actually, my experience was exactly the opposite in this retreat. In fact, after about 4 or 5 weeks, I thought, wow, the cook's really putting more effort into the cooking because the food is tasting better and better every week. But then a few more weeks went by and I realized, no, it's exactly the same food as I had the first week. What was happening is that in the meditation retreat, because we're striving for the state of inner well-being, then what was happening was that all this craving for pleasure was subsiding. And I was finding that I was actually enjoying the taste of the food more and more and more because my mind was settling down into a state of well-being and then appreciating the food more. So it wasn't like there was better food. It was just I was enjoying it more because I didn't have this craving. My state of inner well-being my mind was getting much more calm. And likewise, where I was, there was a beautiful view, you know, on the side of a mountain, spacious view. But again, if we're in a place where there's a beautiful view and we're there day after day, after some time, it just, you know, we don't really appreciate it anymore. Whereas, in fact, I found the exact opposite. Things seem to be becoming more beautiful, not just the view, but little tiny little flowers and things were becoming more beautiful. So what was happening was that the mind was settling down in a more state of inner well-being, and thereby I was really appreciating more and more the simple pleasures around me. So it's not like if we're striving for genuine happiness, we're going to miss out on this. In fact, you'll find that generally you'll appreciate things much, much more than you do now. But here Alan Wallace goes on to say, what is important is not to conflate the two and mistakenly believe that external pleasures will bring lasting happiness. And that's what we tend to do. We tend to, often we're not even really aware of this, and we tend to associate pleasure with happiness and feel, I need more pleasure if I want to be happy. And so we're hoping that pleasurable experiences are going to bring us some sort of lasting happiness. And that's why we have a lot of difficulties in our life. So let's now have a look at these four types of mental balance will contribute to cultivating this state of inner well-being. Now, this state of inner well-being, how do we cultivate that? And here, again, starting our discussion, I'll quote from the article again, and Alan Wallace says, Buddhism promotes an ideal state of well-being that results from freeing the mind of its afflictive tendencies and obscurations and from realizing one's fullest potential in terms of wisdom, compassion, and creativity. In this article, the well-being we are referring to is fundamentally different from hedonic well-being, which includes stimulus-driven pleasures of all kinds. The true causes of such well-being are rooted in a wholesome way of life, are nurtured through the cultivation of mental balance, and come to fruition in the experience of wisdom and compassion. So generally, when we talk about how to cultivate this state of well-being in Buddhism, the standard model that you will see being presented is what's called the three higher trainings. The foundation of any, I think, any sort of meaningful life is ethics, is avoiding harming others, an ethical lifestyle. So this is the foundation. On that basis, then we cultivate concentration. In other words, we develop a calm, clear, focused mind. And on that basis, then we develop wisdom. Particularly here, the wisdom understanding the nature of reality. Because the Buddhist assertion is that the source of suffering is a distorted view of reality, and that if we develop this wisdom understanding the nature of reality, realizing the nature of reality, we can overcome the source of suffering and really achieve that state of genuine happiness. And often when this is described, often you see the presentation is that we need to balance this practice of wisdom with the other wing of practice, the compassion wing of practice. So generally, this is the standard model that you'll see being presented in Buddhism as how to achieve this state of well-being or genuine happiness. But here this evening, we're using a slightly different model, a model that's being presented in this article where Alan Wallace is trying to bridge the understanding of Buddhism and psychology. And so he's using a slightly different model that draws on both Buddhism and psychology in terms of how to cultivate this state of well-being. And those are these four elements of mental balance. And so we're going to have a look at those and see how we can cultivate those to strive for genuine happiness or well-being. So the model is that first we talk about motivational balance. And motivational balance, in this article, it says, is results from reality-based desires and intentions that are oriented towards one's own and others' happiness. So motivational balance is talking about developing healthy aspirations and desires for the pursuit of happiness. So unless we have healthy aspirations or desires, then of course our pursuit of happiness is not going to go anywhere in a good direction. So this is the foundation that we need to develop. On that basis, the second element we really need to develop is attentional balance. And again, here in this article, attentional balance is defined as the ability to sustain a voluntary flow of attention with a quality of awareness that is suffused by ease, focus, and clarity. In other words, here, attentional balance is simply developing a calm, clear, focused mind. And on the basis of developing a calm, clear, focused mind, we can cultivate the other two areas of mental balance. Which are cognitive and emotional balance. And again, here, cognitive balance, this article says, it involves engaging with the world of experience without projecting assumptions or ideas which cause us to misapprehend reality. So cognitive balance is all about seeing reality as it is, without projecting and distorting what we apprehend. And emotional balance here is defined, it says, is its emotional balance is achieved when one has awareness of one's own and others' emotions, emotional triggers, and emotional behaviours as they arise, and making wise choices while engaging with emotional experience. So emotional balance is all about responding to situations in a constructive way rather than reacting to situations with things like mental afflictions such as anger and jealousy and so forth. So this is emotional balance. So what we find here is that in this article we have these four elements in the model of how to cultivate a state of mental balance and well-being. And there is a reason for presenting them in this way, because each one of these is a basis for the following type of cultivation. But also what we're going to see this evening is that each one also, it's not just a one-way system, that they all are interrelated and they all support each other. And so we're going to have a look at how each one of these supports the other elements. And we're going to see that if you take any one of those four elements out, you're not going to really have a very effective method of achieving well-being or genuine happiness. So that's what we're going to be looking at. So let's have a look now on how to cultivate each one of these four elements. And we're going to start with motivational balance. Now, with each one of these four, we currently have all sorts of imbalance. And we can talk about imbalance in three ways. The first is deficit, and that means not enough. So we don't have enough of what we're supposed to have. The second imbalance is hyperactivity, meaning too much. And the third imbalance is dysfunctional. So we're going to have a look at each one of these four areas in terms of these imbalances and then how to overcome these imbalances to achieve a state of balance. So again, first we're going to look at the first of the four types of mental balance, and that is motivational balance. And again, first we're going to have a look at the imbalances, what sorts of imbalances we have now in terms of our motivations. So in terms of deficit, it means a sort of, we don't have any aspirations for happiness. So this is like a state of apathy. State of apathy or a loss of desire for happiness. Hyperactivity is here often it's obsessive desires. And then we have dysfunctional imbalance. And dysfunctional here is having desiring things which are actually not conducive to happiness. And in particular here, in terms of dysfunctional desires, not only sometimes do we desire things that bring us directly suffering, but one of the dysfunctional aspirations or desires for happiness we have here is desiring or hoping or believing that things outside of ourselves are going to bring us lasting, genuine happiness. And this often then leads to a lot of obsessive desires, a lot of obsessive craving for things in the hope that it's going to bring us happiness. And then often when this doesn't fulfill us, we often end up in this state. So it's really our dysfunctional aspirations or desires which often lead to these other two imbalances. And in fact, on this point, there's a very well-known quote from a great Indian master called Shantideva from the 8th century who says, those desiring to escape from suffering hasten right toward their own suffering. And with the very desire for happiness out of delusion, they destroy their own well-being as if it were the enemy. So particularly in terms of these obsessive desires, which often come from this idea or thought or belief that happiness lies out there, we end up being addicted to all sorts of things. You know, we become addicted to sensory stimulation. We become addicted to intellectual stimulation. We become addicted in terms of OCD thinking, obsessive compulsive thinking. And we're simply also become addicted to doing things. Like we always have to do something. And in fact, this was very much highlighted. Maybe some of you read this. I think it was last year or earlier this year. Time magazine did a study. And what they did was they put people in a small room, plain room, there was nothing to see, and there was just a chair in the middle, and they put people and they had to sit there for 15 minutes, and they had a choice of just sitting there doing nothing. The only thing they could do was they gave each person a small device that could give themselves an electrical shock. And 65% of men preferred to give themselves electrical shock rather than sitting there doing nothing. And women were a bit better, only 20, but still 25% of women preferred to give themselves electrical shock than rather just sitting there quietly for 15 minutes. So this is how much we are addicted to stimulus and doing things. And when we're deprived of that, we're like, we don't know what to do. We need to do something. You know, we need to stimulate ourselves. So that's how much we're stuck in this imbalance of hyperactivity in our modern world, unfortunately. But of course, the good news is that we can overcome these imbalances and achieve motivational balance, healthy aspirations and desires for happiness. So let's see how we can do that. So how do we cultivate this motivational balance? The first point here, and this is something that actually goes across all four elements of balance, is that we need certain tools to be able to develop these states of balance. That the two primary tools we use in pretty well all of these four elements of balance is mindfulness and introspection. Mindfulness, of course, is our ability to focus on an object without becoming distracted. And introspection is, in psychology, often called metacognition, the ability to monitor our internal states. So now these two tools for us are not very well developed. And so if we don't develop these two tools, then we won't be able to achieve any of these balances, because no matter how much we want to have that balance, if we don't have these two tools, we're not going to be able to implement any of these instructions. The same goes in all Buddhist practices. If we don't have these two elements, no matter how much we want to cultivate things, we're not going to be able to do it. So first, of course, we need here this introspection to notice that when we're stuck in these imbalances, particularly here, these obsessive desires and cravings and so forth. So we need the ability to notice that, to see that we're in these states of imbalance. And then using mindfulness in particular here, we can use mindfulness of simply breathing to really help us to reduce the imbalance, particularly of hyperactivity, of obsessive desires, obsessive compulsive thinking, obsessive stimulation, craving for stimulation. So simply by focusing on the breath, we can get out of our obsessive compulsive thinking into the body and really start to overcome that extreme of hyperactivity, of obsessive desires. But then, of course, we need to do more than that. Is that we need to cultivate motivational balance, of course, we need to develop a healthy aspiration, desires. To do that, we need to know where is the source of happiness and where is the source of suffering. So the second area to cultivate motivational balance is to have a look at what are the true causes of happiness and suffering. Because until we can identify this, we're not going to be able to have motivational balance. We're not going to be able to have healthy aspirations for happiness. We are still going to hope, for example, that we can find genuine happiness out there somewhere. So any of you who have done any study within the Buddhist field will know that how we do this is by reflecting on the first two of the four noble truths, the truth of suffering and the truth of cause of suffering. So by reflecting on these two noble truths, by reflecting on the first one, the truth of suffering, we're going to really come to appreciate that those pleasant experiences, those stimulus-based pleasures that we have, are never going to fulfill us. They're simply transient, temporary experiences. And by reflecting on the second noble truth, the truth of cause of suffering, we're going to realize that the cause of suffering is within our own mind. We're going to realize that the real underlying cause of our suffering is our mental afflictions, things like anger, craving, jealousy, fear, anxiety, and so forth. And so when we come to realize this, then we're going to understand that we can eliminate these causes of suffering and really find a state of genuine happiness. And so by understanding that, we will really start to develop motivational balance. We're going to start to develop some healthy aspirations and desires for happiness, a state of genuine happiness, rather than having a motivation of trying to just simply have more pleasure in the hope that it's going to fulfill us. So this is how we can cultivate motivational balance, using initially these two tools, and then on that basis to really investigate the true causes of happiness and suffering. So this is very briefly how to cultivate motivational balance. We'll now have a look at attentional balance. So on the basis of cultivating this, we can go on to cultivate attentional balance and cognitive and emotional balance. So we can see if we don't cultivate this as the basis, as long as we have no desire for happiness or dysfunctional desires or obsessive desires, then none of these other three balances are going to even be possible. So we first need to sort this out. Once we've got the healthy direction aspirations, we can then cultivate the other three elements. The second element is attentional balance. And attentional balance, of course, is cultivating a calm, clear, focused mind. If we don't put any effort into this, then developing cognitive and emotional balance are going to be impossible. Because no matter how much we want to develop cognitive and emotional balance, or in other words, wisdom and compassion, our mind will be simply distracted and dull, and we're not going to be able to develop those in any meaningful way. So therefore, we need to cultivate attentional balance. So again, first, we'll have a look at what sorts of imbalances we have now, and then how to overcome them. So when we talk about the imbalance of a deficit of not enough, here in attentional balance, what we're talking about, of course, is dullness. Our mind is very dull, not clear. And when we talk about hyperactivity too much, of course, in attentional balance, that means distraction. We're all over the place. And here, then, also we can talk about dysfunctional attention. And dysfunctional attention means to attend to things in very dysfunctional or afflictive ways. This is really overcome by cultivating the other three types of balance: motivational, cognitive, and emotional. So what we're going to have a look at now here is how to overcome these: deficit hyperactivity, or in other words, dullness and distraction, so that we can cultivate a calm, clear, focused mind. So in terms of cultivating attentional balance then, the imbalances were dullness and distraction. So to overcome those, we are developing two qualities. So the imbalance, the hyperactivity, the imbalance of distraction, then to overcome that imbalance, we are developing what's called stability. We are developing developing the quality of stability, a stable mind, so that we're not becoming distracted. And then the other imbalance, of course, was dullness. We can't focus very clearly. So the quality we're trying to develop there to overcome that imbalance is clarity, to develop a clear focus. So we want our mind to be stable and clear. But I like to add a third quality here, and an imbalance that for us in our modern society we need to really pay attention to. Otherwise, we won't be able to develop these two qualities and overcome these two imbalances. And that is the quality of relaxation. The reality is that when we come into this training and into meditation in general, our background in our modern society is we have fast-paced lives, bombarded by stimulus. Our minds tend to be very agitated, very tense, very stressed. And so when we come into this practice, and in meditation in general, what we do here, of course, we're trying to focus the mind on a single object. And what we do now, of course, in daily life is when we want to focus on something, because our minds are so chaotic, we tense. We do that because if we don't feel like we tense to focus, we feel like we're just going to get distracted. And if we only need to focus for a short time, that can sort of work. But we know from our own experience, if we have to focus for a longer period of time with tension, we become completely exhausted and often become super agitated. So this is not how we want to meditate. And unfortunately, this is how many of us begin meditation. We sit down and the instruction might be focus on your breathing. And then people focus on their breathing with a lot of tension, and then they complain that the meditation makes them exhausted and even get headaches from meditating. Because the problem here is we're too tight, we're too tense. So I think for many of us, when we begin meditation, the main problem in our meditation is this. We're too tight, we're too tense, we're trying too hard. Particularly with this practice, but any meditation practice, the first thing we need to do is learn how to relax. Unfortunately, many of us have forgotten how to do that. We need to relax the body, we need to relax the mind. If we don't do that, there's no way we're going to develop a stable, clear mind. It's impossible. There's no way of developing cognitive balance. There's no way of developing emotional balance. So here, really, the first thing we need to do is learn how to relax. Relax, relax, relax the body and relax the mind. Then on that basis, we can develop a more stable and clear mind and achieve attentional balance, overcoming dullness and distraction. Now, again, in this attentional balance, the two main tools we're using, as we saw before, is mindfulness and introspection. Mindfulness, again, is to be able to hold the object. And then introspection is quality control, is monitoring, are we becoming dull or distracted or too tense, and then adjusting the focus as needed. So again, we're using the same two tools of mindfulness and introspection in developing this attentional balance. Now, with this attentional balance training, what we are doing is we are, in the meditation practice, we are simply focusing on a single object. What object should we focus on in this training? And here, there are a number of possibilities. In fact, the general recommendation in this practice is pick the object that works best for you in this training. For most of us, that's probably going to be the breath. And the meditation texts here say, if you're the sort of person who is highly discursive, meaning always thinking, 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 then definitely the best object for you is the breath. Why? Because by focusing on the physical sensations of the breath, it gets us out of our OCD, obsessive compulsive thinking mind and into the body. And most of our thinking is about the past and the future. Very rarely are we in the present moment. The sensations of the breath only happen in the present moment. So if you focus on them, not only does it get us out of our conceptual mind and into the body, it gets us out of the past and the future into the present moment. So for the vast majority of us in this training, the breath is going to probably be the best object of focus. There are a couple of variations of this practice. The first is what's called full body, and that is simply to focus and notice sensations anywhere in the body associated with the breathing. This particularly is very good for developing relaxation. Another variation of the breath practice is to focus on the area of the abdomen, the rising and lowering of the abdomen as you breathe. Again, this is quite an easy point to focus on, and this is very good for developing attentional stability to stabilize the mind. And the third option with the breath practice is to focus at the entrance of the nostrils. Very much smaller object, and because of that, it's very helpful to improve our clarity, make our mind more clear. So these are the three variations of breath practice which are individually good for developing these qualities, overcoming these imbalances. So for the vast majority of us in this training, the attentional balance, the breath is probably going to be the best object to use. There are two other objects that I think are very helpful for us in our modern society. The second object that can be very helpful is the mind itself, and that means simply to focus on our own mind. The reason this in particular is very good in our modern society is that in our modern society, many of us tend to be the slaves of our mind. We are tormented by our mind. We are often overwhelmed by our own thoughts, emotions, and memories. And often when we have something unpleasant come up in our mind and we don't know how to deal with it, what do? Stuff it down, suppress it, which brings a whole lot of physical problems, and we project a lot of negativity onto others. So we really tend to be the slaves of our mind, tormented by our own minds. By focusing on our own mind in this practice, we are going to develop the ability to simply observe our own mind and whatever is arising, just to simply observe thoughts, emotions, and memories as they arise and pass. And if we do that, then our mind will become naturally more quiet, because we're not feeding these things anymore. And also we're going to then become the masters of our own mind. So this practice, I think, is very beneficial, particularly for us in our modern society. The third object that we can focus on in this practice, which is, again, I think very beneficial in our modern society, is actually no object. Sometimes it's called awareness of awareness. In this practice, What we are doing is simply resting in awareness itself. We're simply being aware of being aware. Now, when we are focusing on any particular object, we're explicitly aware of being aware of the object, and we're implicitly aware of being aware of the object. So all we're doing in this practice is we're making that explicit. We're simply explicitly becoming aware of being aware without really attending to any object. The reason this is so beneficial in our modern society is, again, we tend to be always caught up in appearances. Whatever appears to us, we grasp onto it, we identify with it, and we often then have a lot of difficulties. And our mind then contracts around the appearances, and our mind becomes very constricted and small. Whereas if we simply rest in awareness, awareness is infinite, it's open. So if we can simply rest in awareness, what we're developing here is a very open, spacious, still mind, because awareness is still. There can be a lot of movement in appearances, but the awareness itself is always still. So if we simply rest in that experience and we get used to resting in this very open, spacious, still state, then in daily life, we can always be in that open, spacious, still state, no matter what's happening around us. So for this reason, I think this can be a very beneficial practice or object to use. So here then, in attentional balance, we focus on one of these objects, or it could be maybe another object that you prefer, to develop a relaxed, stable, and clear mind. So this is attentional balance. Once we've, of course, have developed a very relaxed, stable, clear mind, then this is a good basis for developing both cognitive and emotional balance. So we'll have a look at now cognitive balance, then we'll have a tea break, and then after that we'll look at emotional balance and the integrated model, and then some question and answer session. So remember, cognitive balance is basically, as it's defined here, it says it involves engaging with the world of experience without projecting assumptions or ideas which cause us to misapprehend reality. So again, here, cognitive balance is all about seeing reality as it is, rather than projecting or distorting what we apprehend. And of course, the Buddhist assertion is that this is the root of our suffering. That the root of our suffering is this distortion, is distorting reality, is projecting things or misapprehending the reality in front of us. So let's have a look at first the three imbalances here in cognitive balance. So deficit here is in terms of not actually seeing what's present in front of us. Then we have hyperactivity. Is the other extreme of then projecting on what's actually there. And those two then lead to dysfunctional balance. And here, so here, dysfunctional is basically a distorted view of reality from either not seeing what's actually there or projecting on top of what's there. And we end up with a dysfunctional, distorted view of reality. Here, generally, we talk about three main ways that we distort reality, that we have dysfunctional cognitive balance. The first is that things are stable. For example, we tend to feel as if, you know, this is the same cup that was here yesterday, it'll be the same cup here tomorrow. Whereas in fact, we at least intellectually know that's not true. Science has proven, and we learnt at school, that everything's changing in every single moment. So intellectually, we know that things are not stable, that actually things are changing in every given moment. But this is not how we see reality around us experientially. Experientially, instinctively, this is the same cup that was here yesterday, it'll be the same cup here tomorrow. That's how we relate to the world. And that's imbalance. And we know that intellectually, that that is false. Yet, experientially, instinctively, that's what we do. So we have a huge cognitive imbalance there. And that, from a Buddhist perspective, of course, leads to a lot of problems and suffering. So that's the first way in which we have cognitive imbalance. Another way is that that things are the source of happiness. So again, maybe intellectually we appreciate that things around us are not really the source of our happiness, that they can't bring us any genuine or lasting happiness. Maybe intellectually we know that. But again, instinctively, experientially, that's how we behave. That's why we have a lot of craving and attachment for things, because instinctively we believe that somehow they're going to fulfill us and satisfy us. Whereas at least often intellectually we know that's false. So experientially we have this cognitive imbalance, and that's why we grasp to pleasant experience hoping that they're going to bring us some sort of genuine happiness. And another way in which we're dysfunctional, and this is the root cause really, is that there is an autonomous agent, meaning there seems to be this autonomous me here that somehow exists separate from everything else. And from a Buddhist perspective, this is the core cognitive imbalance, that this is the source of all of our suffering. So how do we overcome these imbalances? How do we achieve cognitive balance? So let's have a look at that now. And here then, we saw that we have three core dysfunctional imbalances. So generally, in terms of cultivating cognitive balance, there are three things to overcome those three imbalances. And here this is generally called the three marks of existence. So these are three things that we are to come to realize to overcome those imbalances. The first is impermanence. So here, of course, impermanence means to come to realize things are changing moment by moment. But again, I think all of us realize that or understand that intellectually now. But here, when we're talking about cultivating cognitive balance, we're not simply talking about having a correct intellectual understanding. That's not enough. In fact, why? Because our behavior is not driven by our intellectual understanding. Our behavior is driven by our instinctive habits. We need to overcome those instinctive habits. So in terms of cultivating cognitive balance, it's not enough to understand intellectually these three points. We need to internalize these intellectual ideas. We need to come to realize them and thereby overcome those imbalances. So often here in this training, we have to go through three stages. And here I like to use the Tibetan words because they're very short. Gol Nyam Tok. So the first stage, the first thing we need to do is gol. And in Tibetan and the English that means intellectual. So first we need to gain a correct intellectual understanding of these points. Regarding impermanence, I think we all have that already. Science proved it. We learned it at school. I think we all intellectually accept that things are changing moment by moment. I think none of us have any problem with that. But again, that's not enough to overcome this imbalance because our behavior is not driven by our intellectual understanding. We need to overcome our instinctive habit of seeing things as stable. To do that, we need to go to Nyam and particularly Tok. Nyam means taste or experience. So what we need to do with this is meditate on this and bring this intellectual understanding into experience, to come to taste or experience impermanence in meditation. What that will do is then we're bringing our intellectual understanding into experience. That will have a very strong impact on our mind. So much so that maybe after the meditation, this is still affecting our mind, maybe for some minutes, hours, or even days. During that time, we are still then experientially seeing things as changing moment by moment. So for a short time then, we have some cognitive balance of impermanence. But this will wear off and we'll go back to our dysfunctional imbalance. So we need to go to the next stage to stabilize this and make it long-lasting. And that's Tok. Which is realization. We need to come to realize impermanence directly in meditation. To be able to do this, of course, we need a very stable mind. That's why the basis of cognitive balance is attentional balance. If we don't have a calm, clear, focused mind, there's no way we're going to get here. We probably won't even really get here if our mind is completely distracted and dull when we're trying to meditate on this. So without some sort of attentional balance, we're not going to get to these stages. It's simply going to remain an intellectual idea which won't really improve our life. So that's why attentional balance is the basis of cognitive balance. So if we can come to realize impermanence, we can start to develop cognitive balance, overcoming the imbalance of grasping onto things as being stable. The second is to come to realize suffering. But here, what we're talking about is the original Sanskrit word dukkha. Because here, this word is simply referring to the state we find ourselves in now, our very existence. And we need to really internalize that to come to understand that we're stuck in this unsatisfactory state. This unsatisfactory state, or in Sanskrit, dukkha, is why is our life unsatisfactory? One, because we have unpleasant suffering experiences. That's easy. At a more subtle level, why is our life unsatisfactory? Is because our pleasant experiences always come to an end. But at the deepest level, why is our life unsatisfactory? Is because we have mental afflictions in our mind. We have things like anger, craving, jealousy in our mind. As long as they're there, we're stuck. There's always the potential for suffering to arise. So if we can really appreciate this fact, we can overcome the imbalance of believing things out there are the source of our happiness. We'll realize that's not the case. But then at the deepest level, we need to come to realize there's no autonomous self. There is no autonomous me here somewhere. Because here we overinflate the sense of me. We believe and grasp onto what's called self. This is a overinflated sense of me. And this is the core problem, according to Buddhism. And to overcome this, we need to also intellectually understand there's no self here, and then come to taste and experience and realize this in meditation. Of course, we're not saying here there's no me. What we're saying is we need to overcome a dysfunctional way of how we see ourselves existing. We overinflate the sense of me. This false sense of me, this overinflated sense of me, is grasping onto this autonomous self. We need to understand there's no such me, no such autonomous self. So if we can realize these, we can really cultivate the cognitive balance. So that is the third of the four types of mental balance. What we'll do now is we'll take a 15-minute break. We'll come back and look at the fourth mental balance, type of mental balance, the emotional balance. And then we'll have a look at how we integrate those, and then time for a lot of question answer. So let's have a cup of tea and biscuit. So we've been looking this evening at this four-element model in terms of how to cultivate genuine happiness or well-being. The core element, the foundational element of motivational balance, of developing healthy aspirations and desires, striving for genuine happiness. On that basis, to go on to develop attentional balance, developing a calm, clear, focused mind. And then on that basis, to develop the two other elements of cognitive and emotional balance. We just looked at cognitive balance in terms of being able to see reality as it is without projecting or distorting what we apprehend. And now we're looking at the final element of emotional balance. So let's see what's involved there. As the other three, we can start by looking at the imbalances and then how to overcome those imbalances to cultivate emotional balance. So here in terms of emotional balance, the deficit would be to have basically, again, apathy or indifference. In other words, not emotionally engaging with our experiences is really in this very indifferent, apathetic state. And then hyperactivity, of course, is characterized here by the two elements of either attachment or aversion. And then dysfunctional, in terms of the imbalance in terms of dysfunctional, is we're talking about here engaging in emotional experiences in a very dysfunctional way. And in particular here we're talking about reacting to situations in particular in terms of anger and jealousy and craving and so forth. So to react to situations rather than responding in a healthy way. So to overcome these imbalances, we'll have a look at how to cultivate emotional balance. And here we can talk about four elements to cultivate to overcome these imbalances. The first element to cultivate is loving kindness. And loving kindness here is defined as the wish for ourselves and others to be happy. We need to distinguish this from attachment, because often we don't clearly distinguish loving kindness and attachment. And often, unfortunately, particularly in things like relationships, we tend to feel like they're sort of more or less the one thing. And we can't clearly distinguish it, and we end up with a lot of problems because of that. So in terms of loving kindness, again, it's the wish for ourselves and others to be happy. So here, generally it's better to use this word loving kindness than the word love, because generally when we use the word love, we're really talking about an emotion, and it often implies some sort of intimate behavior. Whereas here, this loving kindness is not really an emotion, and it's certainly not a behavior. Loving kindness is actually an aspiration. It's a wish. It's an aspiration for ourselves and others to be happy. And we need to be able to clearly distinguish this from attachment. And the way we can distinguish that in relationship is quite easy, actually, if we understand what these two things are, loving kindness and attachment. Loving kindness in a relationship is simply the wish for the person to be happy. And the fine print, of course, is without expecting anything in return, which what we would call unconditional love or no strings attached love. Strings attached love is love polluted by attachment. And that sounds like this. I will love you as long as, and here comes the condition, I will love you as long as you keep saying and doing things that make me happy. So that's attachment. Attachment is all about me, 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 me. And attachment is actually turning the other person into an object to satisfy me. And very simply, to distinguish the two, love or loving kindness is saying, I want you to be happy. Attachment is saying, I want you to make me happy. So that's the distinction. So therefore, we need to distinguish these two elements, which usually are mixed up, and we need to increase the loving kindness part and decrease the attachment part as much as possible. So this is the first quality that we're trying to cultivate in emotional balance, this aspiration for ourselves and others to have happiness and its causes. Very closely related to that is a second quality of compassion, which is the wish for ourselves and others to be free of suffering and its causes. Now, generally with these two qualities we're trying to cultivate here, it's recommended we cultivate them in stages. That first, with these two qualities, we cultivate them to people close to us because it's most easy. Then we expand that out to include people we don't know very well. And then we start to expand it out to people who we find a bit difficult. And then eventually to everyone. So these are the stages that are usually recommended. But I think in our modern society, we need to add an extra stage at the very beginning. And that is, we need to cultivate loving kindness and compassion to ourselves first. Normally, originally, this was never mentioned because people historically generally felt okay about themselves, so we didn't need to emphasize this. But unfortunately, in our modern society, that's often not the case. It seems to be in the modern society an epidemic of low self-esteem, guilt, and self-hatred. So we need to address this first. We need to cultivate loving kindness and compassion to ourselves first before we can expand it out to others. Now, the third quality that is to be cultivated here is what's called empathetic joy. And this is also, I think, sorely needed in our modern society, because in our modern society, we tend to always focus on the negative with ourselves and others. And so we have a completely imbalanced view of ourselves and others. So empathetic joy is about balancing more. It's about rejoicing in our own and others' virtue and good fortune. So it's focusing on the positive aspects of ourselves and others. And also by rejoicing in particularly others' virtue and well-being, then it also is an antidote to jealousy, which also seems to be very strong in our modern society. So this is very important. And the fourth quality we're trying to cultivate here is equanimity. Equanimity is basically an equal attitude towards others. Towards everyone. It's a sense of closeness to everyone. Now, our attitude towards others is not one of equanimity, it's biased, imbalanced. And generally, we tend to categorize people into one of three groups depending on how they affect us. Those people around us who seem to support me in my happiness, we put in the friend group. Those people around us who don't seem to affect me in my happiness in any way, the stranger group. And those people around us who seem to interfere with me in my happiness, the so-called enemy group. So we categorize people into these three groups solely on the perspective of how they affect us. And then, of course, we have a very biased attitude. Because to the so-called friends, who seem to be the source of our happiness, we have a lot of attachment and craving. To the group, the strangers who don't seem to affect me in my happiness, we often become very apathetic, indifferent. And the so-called enemy who seems to be interfering with me in my happiness, aversion, hostility, anger, hatred. So we have attachment to friends, apathy to strangers, hostility, anger, and hatred to difficult people. Equanimity is about overcoming all of those. Equanimity is to develop a sense of closeness to everyone. Understanding we're all stuck in the same situation. We're all struggling to be happy, struggling to be free of suffering. And if we can really cultivate this, then cultivating these qualities towards everyone becomes much more easy. So this is how we cultivate emotional balance, is to cultivate these four qualities to overcome these imbalances here. So this is very briefly how to cultivate emotional balance. So I've got some more things to say, but maybe now is a good point to stop for a moment and see if there's any questions about anything we've covered so far this evening. So does anyone have any questions about any of the four balances that we looked at?
Yeah, in terms of, you mentioned the three higher trainings to begin with.
Yeah.
And then you've gone through the four factors.
Yeah.
Where does ethics play a part in terms of the four factors?
Yeah. Okay. Ethics is actually in all of these.
Right.
Cognitive balance, of course, is about seeing reality as it is. And from a Buddhist perspective, ethics, the real foundation of ethics is through the understanding of interdependency. Because if we really understand everything's interdependent and there's a cause and effect relationship, causality, then we're going to be completely ethical. So by developing cognitive balance, then that's going to be an essential ingredient in having ethics. Similarly, emotional balance, by developing loving kindness, compassion, and so forth, this, of course, will be an integral part of ethical lifestyle. And also then in terms of motivational balance, in terms of striving for genuine happiness, inner well-being, rather than externally. Because when we strive for external happiness, usually ethics becomes very problematic because there's competition, you know. You want this, I want that, you get out of my way. So by working on that, then that's going to also feed into the ethics. And of course, attentional balance is going to support all of those elements. So you'll find that the ethics is really tied up in all of these elements. So even though there is some sort of relationship in terms of each one being the basis of the next, they also feed back in. So it's really a whole system here. Similarly with the typical model of the three higher trainings, then, you know, we have ethics as the basis, but also you'll find that by developing this wisdom will feed into ethics, compassion will feed into ethics, and the concentration is going to support all of those. Any other questions?
Yeah, I've got a question about emotional balance.
Correct, okay.
With emotional balance, you were talking about how to cultivate those four aspects.
Yeah.
And one of them was compassion.
Yeah.
And you were talking about how it's important to be compassionate towards ourselves.
Correct.
Before we're compassionate towards others.
Yeah.
And then you mentioned the fact that in our, maybe it's in our Western society, we have these problems with low self-esteem and guilt. So I just wondered if you had any views as to what the cause of that situation
is. I definitely do, and that's one of the things I want to talk about coming up, but maybe before I go there, if there's any other questions first, and then I'll get an answer for you, to you. Anything else anyone would like to bring up? Otherwise, we'll go straight to this point. Correct. Okay, yeah. That was back on the cultivating the attentional balance using what's called no object or awareness of awareness.
Mm. So in my tradition, we look at the observer observing the observed, the observation. I'm just wondering, is that the same quality, awareness?
So here in the mind practice, experientially, you have a sense of being the observer or the witness. That, and in this case, the observer or witness is observing the breath here. Yeah. The observer or witness is observing the mind and all the thoughts and emotions and memories arising and passing. Here, experientially, there's not really that sense of being the separate observer or the witness. Technically, you could say you're observing the mind itself, but experientially, it's not really, you don't have a sense of being the separate observer or witness. So here, you're observing the mind. Here, you're more resting in the mind. So experientially, this is much more a non-dualistic practice. So, you know, sometimes the analogy with this practice is the mind is like the sky and the thoughts are like clouds, you know, this analogy. So here you're sort of observing the sky and the thought, the clouds. Here you're being the sky, not observing the sky. So experientially, and here, of course, in this one, implicitly you're aware of being aware, but here you're just making that explicit. Of course, here thoughts, emotions will continue to arise and appear, but in this practice we're not observing them. We're simply ignoring them. Implicitly they're there, but explicitly we're just being aware, whereas here we are explicitly observing thoughts. So that's also a little bit of a difference. Yeah? Any other questions anyone would like to bring up? Okay, then we'll address the question from before. And that ties into this point here of how we need an integrated model. And that is, particularly here, when we're talking about the emotional balance, there's very much a interplay between cognitive and emotional balance. In particular here, if we don't develop the cognitive balance, then emotional balance is going to be almost impossible to develop. And the reason is, or one reason is, that we have what's called cognitive fusion. So the question is, you know, in emotional balance, we're trying to overcome things like reacting with anger. But why is it that we instinctively get angry with people who behave badly, who try to harm us? And one main reason is because of cognitive imbalance. In fact, to highlight that, if someone is engaging in some sort of harmful behaviour, the correct perspective, in terms of cognitive, to see correctly, is simply to see there is a person doing a harmful or bad action. So that is the correct perspective in terms of cognitive balance. But often, we don't have that correct perspective of cognitive balance. Often when we see someone behaving badly, we have cognitive imbalance in terms of we simply see there is a bad person. So what we're doing is we are cognitively fusing the person and the behaviour and making them one thing. So this is called, in psychology, cognitive fusion. So if we do this cognitively, we're in trouble. In fact, it becomes almost impossible to develop emotional balance. Because if we do this cognitive fusion, then in any given situation, we've got two choices with any situation, accept or reject. And generally, when someone's behaving badly, we reject. It's okay. But the problem is if we do cognitive fusion and we see there is a bad person and we reject, we usually reject the person, i.e. we attack the person, we get angry at the person. But if we understand that attacking or getting angry at the person is not a good thing to do, but we're doing cognitive fusion, so it means then reject is not a valid option. If we go to the other option of accept with cognitive fusion, what we end up doing, of course, is accepting their bad behaviour. So we're in this dilemma that if we have this cognitive fusion, we end up in these two extreme reactions. So, you know, this is not emotional balance. This is emotional imbalance. So what we need to do, of course, if we want to have emotional balance, is to stop the cognitive imbalance. If we can have the correct perspective and see there is a person doing a bad behavior, then we can reject the behavior and accept the person. So we can have compassion for the person. And at the same time, not accept their bad behavior and address their bad behavior. So if we don't have this cognitive balance, we're going to end up with reacting with emotional imbalance. If we have cognitive balance, it's going to be a lot easier to develop compassion for the person and at the same time address their bad behavior. Now, this, of course, equally applies for ourselves. You know, if we've done some negative, harmful thing, the correct perspective cognitively is to simply acknowledge, I have done a harmful behavior. But often we don't have cognitive balance, and we often, if we've done something harmful or bad, we simply go, I'm a bad person. Cognitive fusion. Then, of course, to have compassion for ourselves, I don't deserve it because I'm a bad person. Or they don't deserve it because they're a bad person. Because if we do cognitive fusion, compassion for others and ourselves becomes almost impossible. Because having compassion for a bad person feels like what we're saying, oh, what you did is okay, I don't mind. Of course we should mind. But if we do cognitive fusion, compassion for others who behave badly or compassion for ourselves if we behave badly becomes almost impossible because it feels like we're somehow condoning bad behavior. We're not, but we're doing cognitive fusion. So therefore, if we have cognitive balance, we can have compassion for ourselves and address our bad behavior. And this is actually, I think, where guilt comes in. If we've done something harmful and we feel guilty, what are we focusing on? Bad me. So guilt is based on cognitive fusion. It's based on invalid perspective. So we don't need to feel guilty about anything because it's an invalid reaction. It's a reaction based on cognitive imbalance. So if we've done something harmful and we regret, what are we focusing on? The action. So regret is based on correct cognitive perspective. Acknowledging I have done this negative action, I regret that harmful behavior. So that's the difference between regret and guilt. Guilt is based on cognitive fusion and is completely useless because all it does is it paralyzes us and makes us feel bad. So if we want to overcome guilt, low self-esteem, self-hatred, then, yes, of course we need to develop emotional balance, have love and compassion for ourselves. But if we don't have cognitive balance, we're not going to be able to do that because we're going to be wallowing in this. We're not going to be able to... We can't have good self-esteem if we see ourselves as a bad person. It just doesn't work because bad people don't do good things. Whereas people sometimes do bad things and sometimes do good things. So if we have a correct perspective, then we can have good self-esteem, regret for any harmful action, compassion for ourselves. So unless we have this cognitive balance, then again, to develop emotional balance for ourselves and others becomes almost impossible. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does.
Good.
It's easier said than done, separating the action from the person.
Here we need to be careful. I wouldn't use the word separate. That can lead to the other extreme. Generally, we get stuck in two extremes here. Either fusion, which is identification, or separation. So separation is we do this. And for us, I didn't do anything wrong. It wasn't me. Or if we like the person, but they did a bad thing, we go, they didn't do anything wrong. That's separation.
Yeah.
We don't want to go there. That's an extreme. Yeah. So we're not talking about separating. We're talking about distinguishing. You can't have a person without an agent, without an action without an agent.
So you can be responsible for the
exactly.
action without allowing it to cover the whole of one's...
Exactly. Experience. See, the problem is, the other problem with this, is if we do this with ourselves or others, let's say we do it with ourselves, I'm a bad person, what we do is we end up with a completely imbalanced false view of ourselves. Because bad people don't do good things. So if we see ourselves as a bad person, we can't acknowledge any good things we do because bad and good don't go together. So we sort of same for other people, oh, they're a bad, that's a bad person. So if we see someone as a bad person and they happen to do something good, we go, oh, they didn't mean it, you know. They didn't mean to do that because they're a bad person. Same with ourselves. We can't acknowledge our good qualities or other people's good qualities, so we have a completely biased view of others. The other problem, of course, is this is a fixed, static view. No hope for change. No hope for change. Whereas there's a person who sometimes does some harmful things, sometimes good things for ourselves and others. There's no fixed, biased view. It's completely flexible and open, which and the correct one, of course.
Yeah, I find that quite tricky because we want to keep an open mind. If someone is not really nice towards us, we don't want to put that person in a box and say they like this. In the same for us, if we don't, you know, we behave at our best, and I want to think, well, I'm not a bad person, but I don't want to indulge in that because otherwise I might do it again. So it's quite tricky because it's this balance of the open mind. If I have in my life someone who's not relating sincerely towards me, I really want to forgive it in a way.
Correct.
But I also have to withdraw from that person because otherwise the circle is not. So I can send her or be meta, for instance.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I have also to have a certain withdrawal.
Yeah, but here we're talking about perspective.
Yeah.
And the thing is that now I've lost my point I was going to mention. When we say you've got to have an open mind, the problem is that we tend to be stuck here. And then when someone says have an open mind, what that translates to is this. And that's not acceptable.
You can't accept bad behavior and for myself.
Exactly.
For myself.
But that's how it translates and what people hear. If you're stuck here and someone says, you need to have an open mind, we end up here, which is completely...
Not right either.
So we can only have an open mind if we have this, because open mind is about emotional balance. So there's no... It's impossible to have an open mind if we're stuck in cognitive fusion. It doesn't work. It goes here, and that's a disaster.
Yeah. So the correct perspective towards myself, for instance, if I've done a wrong action, would be to not indulge in, forgive myself, but not feeling guilty either.
No, guilt is all about this.
But not indulging is, oh, it's okay, I'm going to correct it next time. It's not quite right.
That's right. So
I have to be strict with myself as well.
To start to correct that, the first thing you need to do is stop doing this. Because as long as you do this, whatever you try to do in terms of forgiveness and compassion, it won't work. It'll end up here. And that's no good. Because we're going to deny, oh, I didn't do anything wrong. I've got an open mind. I didn't do anything wrong. And that's a disaster because we're not acknowledging. Because we can't, if we're having an open mind, we're saying we're not seeing this, but then we're not acknowledging our negative behaviour.
So towards another person, that would mean have an open mind, they might change before not. This is
to have an open,
not acceptable.
Yeah, exactly. To have an open mind means you have to have it based on this. To an open mind means that technically, there's no such thing as a bad person. They don't exist. There are only people who sometimes do bad behaviour and sometimes do good behaviour. That's an open mind. There's a person, maybe now they're doing something harmful, but they also sometimes do good things. And so with an open mind here, we can have compassion for the person, but, more importantly, not accept their bad behaviour and be very strong about that and say, that behaviour is completely unacceptable, I will not accept that. That's an open mind. Otherwise, we go here and it's a mess. Anything else on this? Related to this, here we're talking about this sort of balance of cognitive balance and emotional balance. Cognitive balance, emotional balance, in a Buddhist perspective, is often referred to as wisdom and compassion, the two wings of wisdom and compassion. And here we're seeing that they need to be cultivated together. That if you only focus on one without the other, mess, potential mess. And in another way, if we don't cultivate wisdom and compassion together and we only do one or the other, we often end up in a lot of difficulties. Often you'll find that if we focus simply on the wisdom wing, the cognitive wing, often without developing the compassion wing together, often what happens is the very nature of the cognitive wing, the wisdom wing, is that people, without developing compassion, is people often become very self-absorbed, very disconnected from the world, and often very insensitive to the sufferings of others. And then in very extreme cases, often when people are engaging in this cognitive training, and in Buddhism it's often referred to as vipassana, insight practice, often when people engage in this, they do a lot of this practice, they often believe that because they're some high-level wisdom practitioner, vipassana practitioner, they've gone beyond ethics. That ethics, that's just for beginners. I do everything with wisdom, so everything I do is fine. And they end up engaging in very harmful, unethical behaviour. So this can happen if we don't do the emotional balance, the compassion wing of practice. Likewise, if we only engage in the emotional balance, we can end up with this problem. But also, what can happen is if we only engage in the compassion wing of practice, then our compassion is very biased. As we mentioned before, is that, you know, I'll help these people because they're nice to me. Those people, they don't deserve my compassion because they're nasty, horrible people. And also without the wisdom, even if we have the best motivation in the world, we try to help others, but we make a big mess and we actually introduce more harm because we don't know how to help. So that's also wisdom we need. But also, and this unfortunately happens with people who have a high degree of natural compassion. Often they want to go out and really fix the world and heal the world. You know, we see this in aid workers and social workers, full of enthusiasm, full of compassion, go out to make the world a change, a difference in the world. And then within 3 to 6 months, compassion burnout, completely burnt out. So this is also compassion without wisdom. Here the wisdom, of course, is knowing what we can do to help, what we can't do to help, and the wisdom of knowing when to rest and look after ourselves. And then there's one last point that probably all of us have experienced many times, is we go to try and help someone and then they take advantage of us, our good nature. So this is also compassion without wisdom. And of course the wisdom here is based on this, meaning if we're trying to help someone and they're trying to take advantage of us, we need to be very firm about their harmful behaviour and not accept that harmful behaviour. So this is very important. Otherwise, people will walk over the top of us. And unfortunately, what happens when this happens is, or the compassion burnout, people wrongly come to the conclusion compassion doesn't work. And they give it up. What's not working is wisdom is missing. It's not that compassion ends up people, it's not compassion causes us to be taken advantage of. No, that's never the case. Why we get taken advantage of is because we're lacking the wisdom, not because of compassion. So all we need to do is introduce the wisdom, and then we're very firm. If people try and take advantage of us, we say, sorry, that is completely unacceptable. I will not accept that behaviour. So then compassion can work in the correct way. So that's another point I wanted to mention. One last point, and then I think we've just about run out of time, is if we go back here, to this four model. So we've seen really how, just now, how these really interact. The attentional balance, of course, is going to be necessary if we really want to cultivate these, and we need to have, of course, the correct aspirations. But the more we develop emotional and cognitive balance, that's going to really feed back into the motivational balance and the attentional balance. I mean, they'll all work together. Now, and this is going to be the topic tomorrow night. We're going to be focusing on attentional balance. The topic tomorrow night is Introduction to Shamatha Practice. So that's the Buddhist name for cultivating attentional balance. So we're going to look at how to do that in more detail tomorrow night. We're going to do a couple of meditations as well. And we saw here, and in all of them, one of the main tools we need to develop is mindfulness. And of course, mindfulness now has become very popular in our modern society in the last 5 or 10 years. And mindfulness that is really cultivated in this. So this is of very much interest. But then unfortunately, a lot of modern day mindfulness movements are looking at these elements and go, oh no, that's all that religious stuff. We don't want that. So let's get rid of this, because that's all that religious stuff, and let's just use this. But as we can see, this without the context becomes completely ineffective. And if we don't have this context, this can actually then just accentuate the bad habits that we have now. So rather than fix any problems, it could just make things worse. So we need to make sure that we have this framework, otherwise this attentional balance, this mindfulness practice will remain very ineffective, and it actually could just promote our dysfunctional lifestyle even more. And there's a term that's been coined for how a lot of the modern day movements have stripped this out and got rid of the rest, and that is muk mindfulness, so fast food mindfulness, so not very healthy. So, but we're going to have a look at this practice in more detail tomorrow night. So that's going to be the talk for tomorrow night. We're going to actually do a couple of meditations as well tomorrow evening. So I think that's about, we've run out of time. So just one last point. And that is that, put it on here. I've got my own website. And I have a lot of audio from these talks and courses and so forth there, and a lot of materials. So if you find anything useful on there, please take it, grab it and use it. And also I have a contact page on there, so if you want to ask me any questions about anything, you can send me a message. I'll try and respond to you as best I can. And so that's all for me this evening. I think we've run out of time, so I hope to see you here tomorrow night, and we'll talk about the shamatha practice, the attentional balance. So thank you very much.